Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, a weekly current affairs program from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, that looks at Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis Podcast and author of RFERL's weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. The five Central Asian leaders met in Kyrgyzstan this week for their annual summit. There were high expectations for this summit since so much has changed since the leaders last met in Turkmenistan last year. So what did they accomplish when they all get together in Kyrgyzstan? To discuss this, I have two of the leading experts on Central Asian affairs. Alex Cooley, former director of Columbia University's Harriman Institute and author of several books on Central Asia, including Great Games, Local Rules, and Dictators Without Borders, and Professor Luca Anceschi from Glasgow University, where he teaches Central Asian studies, and is also the author of several books on Central Asia, including Analyzing Kazakhstan's Foreign Policy, Regime Neo-Eurasianism in the Nazarbayev Era, and Turkmenistan Foreign Policy, Positive Neutrality, and the Consolidation of the Turkmen Regime. Thank you both for being on the program today. I appreciate it. And let's start with something positive. You know, it's the fourth time they're meeting since 2018. Alex, what does this say to you about Central Asian unity?
Well, it's certainly better than not meeting. And I remember, you know, 31 years ago when we had the first of these regional summits and scholars and pundits would write things about, you know, emphasizing the ceremony as opposed to the substance of these meetings, right? And that the purpose back then was to present themselves as leaders of independent states, you know, in a public kind of way, whereas the regional cooperation agenda was very light and, you know, usually nothing of much substance was ever concluded or agreed upon. This time is different in the sense that in the intervening decades, the region has been through a number of attempts to promote regional cooperation. I'll make a note that the majority of these attempts have been externally sponsored, right? Whether it's, you know, the Russian attempt to make the Central Asian states members of their economic and regional, or rather their economic and security regional organizations, whether it's something like the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, or before the kind of Go West Initiative, whether it's kind of the EU attempt to sort of promote its vision on regional cooperation, or, you know, the U.S. attempt to link Afghanistan with Central Asia from the middle of the 2000s. What all of these initiatives have in common was that they were externally imposed onto Central Asian states that were quite wary of them, right, and saw through these kind of geopolitical agendas and wanted to not offend other great powers, right? They wanted to manage the balance. What we're seeing in the last 4 years is something more organic, right? And the really important part is that, for me anyway, the interesting in hearing Luca's comments on this, is that the two most substantial regional powers, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, back this, right? They're the ones who see the importance of having regional cooperation on the Central Asian states' terms. And so, to me, there is an evolution there. It's slow. I think, you know, we'll talk about the problems of the meeting. They weren't able to actually conclude a kind of a basic document of cooperation. I think, you know, the issues among them and the differences and the conflicts are very real, and we shouldn't minimize them. But I think what is different now is that this is being undertaken by the Central Asian states for the Central Asian states and not for someone seeking to impose their regional vision.
Okay, thank you very much. And Luca, I want you to comment on the same thing, but I also am curious on your views of, you know, Turkmenistan is cooperating on this, and that is a change from, you know, their efforts to do this in the 1990s, which admittedly didn't produce very much. But how important is it that Turkmenistan is simply part of this whole effort?
Well, at least they sit down with them. At least they are part of the conversation, which for me, it is, as you said, a step forward. I am not sure what kind of contribution they have made to the discussion. For sure, they haven't signed whatever agreement was finalized in Chulbonatar. So it seems to me that Turkmenistan, it's a part of the conversation, but I am not sure whether they are actively participating or just listening. there is no priority in Turkmen foreign policy for Central Asia has been something that always stayed in confined to the theory, to the letter, but never been implemented. I mean, this is the regionally most engaged, most disengaged state of the five. But going back to the point that Alex was making before, I agree with him. It is important that we recognize that there have been small steps made and that we do have, and this for me is the most important development, we do have, possibly for the first time, the two biggest, most significant regional states, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, who are both on board with the same agenda. Because if you look at historically, Kazakhstani foreign policy and Uzbek foreign policy, both Nazarbayev and Karimov, they always said, we are leading integration, we focus on Central Asia, but what they did was anything else. So Kazakhstan looked at Eurasia, were defined, and Uzbekistan became isolationist. So at this time, we do have the two most important, the biggest economies on board, and we've seen what kind of help that specific framework had in the European context, where France and Germany led integration. Of course, it's a different scenario, but I think that if I have to be optimistic, which is normally not what I would be, I would look particularly at that tandem being developing, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan being fully on board.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a good point, but then I'm going to follow up with that. And Alex, I'm going to ask you about this too. But Luca, I'll let you go first. In the 1990s, they tried to do this too, right? There was the Central Asian Union, became the Central Asian Economic Union. And certainly when it was the Central Asian Union, it was always Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Okay, Tajikistan had a civil war on. They did join the Central Asian Economic Union after the civil war ended. Turkmenistan under Niyazov just wasn't even interested. Are we running the risk of having the same kind of organization evolve again that really only involves three countries and not five?
I think we do. The only difference which I can perceive is that these leaders may be somewhat different from their predecessors, but also the choices of the 90s were choices that were reacting, responding to the drama of the Soviet collapse, whereas there was no foreign policy expertise, the diplomatic class of Central Asia was very underdeveloped, and all they could think of was continuing on with the kind of policies that they had, in the sense that they were trained, they were almost forced to see each other as going, to see them as going together in the same direction. And there was no imaginative answers. Now it's 30 years down the track. They've gone full circle, as Alex mentioned before. They know the external world. They know the dangers that are, they exist in a context in which the region is disintegrated. So I think that we now at the other side of the spectrum, and now integration, if pursued meaningfully, is an answer to problems that they know, rather than just something that happened because they didn't know what to do when the union collapsed. So even though you still have three states only, I think that the context is somewhat different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And Alex, I'm going to do the same question. Obviously, I want you to answer the same question, but also in your view, is part of this because, let's face it, Tajikistan, Emomali Rahman, how much longer can he be there? Is his participation really even that necessary at the moment? And do you see Turkmenistan is, they're there, but their traditional role is their neutral country. Do you see them ever playing a really active role in an organization like this?
Yeah, thanks for that, Bruce. So let me build a bit on what Luca said. So I think there's a couple of new variables this time around, right, that would even make, if you just take the Kazakh, Kyrgyz, Uzbek configuration, make it more significant this time around. First, we have an Uzbekistan that, whatever its issues and unimplemented reforms that we would like to see, we have a government that is very much more open in terms of border management, in terms of regional cooperation, in terms of wanting to improve the investment climate and encourage trade. And that's a contrast to the trajectory the last time around. So in the 1990s, Uzbekistan was never super open, but it was more open in the mid-1990s. And then as we got into the late 1990s and, you know, fears of Islamic militants and Karimov became more and more paranoid, he increasingly militarized the border and anything to do with the border. Yeah. And so here, you know, Uzbekistan is going to play a much different role. The second point I would make is that now we also have constituencies at the local and regional level, especially on the borders of some of these countries, whose governors and whose mayors are also interested in promoting and institutionalizing some sort of regional cooperation, even if it's sort of low scale transport links, tourism, different kinds of sort of work and residency regimes. Like all of these, I think, are good natural organic drivers. So I think those are the two sort of key differences why this time around we might see more incremental progress. But the way I would sort of frame it is I think Ramon of today is becoming who Karimov was, right? Someone who is increasingly paranoid, obsessed with his own authority and consolidating it, using regional turbulence and the environment in Afghanistan to justify the security crackdown and set of operations in Gordabarakshan. And I think the other part of this is that Ramon himself has really tied his own identity and that of sort of aspiring Tajik statehood to this sense of sort of being under siege and surrounded from all areas. Yeah. So all of that is a recipe for, not a lot of openness to sort of substantive regional cooperation, but also continued volatility and aggression on these borders. Regarding Turkmenistan, I think it's still a little early to say definitively. You know, for me, it gets back to the age-old question of just like the lack of real state capacity in Turkmenistan to manage a complex array of issues that are necessary for actual integrative processes, border management, you know, regional foreign affairs. You know, there's a sense that there is this sort of still paranoia that all outside kinds of influences might be destabilizing or subversive to the state. So, you know, Serdar still has that. But, you know, for me, without the kind of really trained bureaucracy in international standards, norms, rules, technologies, the way you have, say, in Kazakhstan, you know, Turkmenistan is going to have a difficult time adjusting to any of these substantive kind of functional agreements, even if the political will was there.
Okay, thank you. And you know, some of the, it's certainly in the Kyrgyz side, the Tajik, you know, Rahman's reluctance and in the end refusal to sign this agreement, you know, on friendship and cooperation in the 21st century was for obvious reasons greeted very coldly. You know, was there, do you, in your opinion, I'm just curious, and I know this is speculation, but was Rahman reluctant to sign this just because of the Kyrgyz Tajik border conflict? Because that's how a lot of people in Kyrgyzstan see this.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly seems to be one factor that's circulating around media reports. I do think this is part of his state building strategy. And, you know, part of what gives him his sort of, you know, claim to political authority and legitimization. And so, you know, remember, he's been sort of on two conflicts over the last couple of years, or rather three, right? Regarding what was going on in Afghanistan when the Taliban took power, right? Hard line Ramon took compared with all the other Central Asian states, right? The concern about the displacement of sort of Tajiks from positions in authority in the new Afghan government. The actual border conflict with Kyrgyzstan, right? Where he felt as if, you know, he taught, you know, this Kyrgyz government a lesson, you know, responding to sort of, you know, what he considered to be nationalizing rhetoric, whether it's justified or not, I think is debatable. And then three, this internal operation that he had. So that's an extraordinary amount of conflicts to be engaged in, right? If you're a Central Asian ruler. And so, you know, whether, you know, that was the determining factor on this or not, I do think he is projecting this idea that, you know, he is strong, the country is embattled. He wants to be courted, whether it's by, you know, China, Russia, the United States, or sort of other actors. And, you know, that's why I mentioned it's Karimov-like, right? That there's a sense of sort of being under siege and embattled.
Okay, thank you very much. And we're getting pretty close to the midway point. I promised everyone that I was going to try to keep this to my desired limit. So I'll take this opportunity to say once again that this is the Medjlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast on current affairs in Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinero. I'm hosting the Medjlis Podcast, and it is my pleasure today to welcome two of the legends in the field, Luke Anceschi, Professor of Central Asian Studies at Glasgow University, Alex Cooley, former director of the Harriman Institute, Columbia University, and I believe professor at Barnard College right now. Is that correct?
Yep. That's me.
Okay, that's good. And the list of books from these two people go on and on and on. And if you don't know, then you've been hiding in a cave for all these years, because there's a wealth of material out there from both these people. And just give them a, you know, look it up on the internet and you'll find it. Okay, so we're going to go to the second half. And Luke, I want to start with you too. You know, and especially now, and we're going to talk about some of the stuff that didn't happen that probably should have happened. But, you know, at a time when the Russian trade routes are in jeopardy, some of them are already closed down, and everyone's talking about trying to move goods through Central Asia through a number of means, either across the Caspian or south of the Caspian. And we just saw a train that went from northeast Kazakhstan, you know, through Turkmenistan and through Iran and on the way to Turkey carrying a shipment of goods. And then, of course, I mentioned they're trying to open up the Trans-Caspian route, where they have new ports or modernized ports at Turkmenbashi and Turkmenistan and Kyrgyz and Aktau and Kazakhstan. And, of course, the Alat port in Azerbaijan has been built and it's ready to go. At a time like this, it's kind of interesting that Turkmenistan wouldn't sign a friendship and cooperation agreement. Now, we know that neutrality is a very undefined issue in Turkmenistan, but how, you know, it seems to be in Turkmenistan's economic interests, which has always been the defining principle of really of its neutrality, to have signed on to this kind of agreement. What role do you see Turkmenistan playing? It seems like they need regional cooperation. Why not sign the document? Why not sign the friendship agreement?
I think that, unfortunately, when we now talk about Turkmenistan economic interest, we are talking exclusively about the economic interest of the elite that has been running the country in the last 15 years. Father and son at the helm, but there are a few of them who are on below them as well, because I think that the interest, Bruce, is currently satisfied only by exporting gas to China, because that's enough for pursuing the kleptocratic agenda. So it seems to me that if we focus on that specific aspect of the economic relation, which is a great part because this is a rentier state, we then realize that the difference between what is happening, what should be happening, it's quite wide, it's quite significant. And when I was doing research on the field, then I was looking at the ties between Central Asia and the Gulf states, I pretty soon in my research found out that the missing link was just Turkmenistan, because they have a long border with Iran. They could be the conduit for kind of north-south trade, but we haven't seen anything developing in the last 5 or 6 years, ever since my research was completed. And you would expect that given the current situation, you know, with the war and the blockade of the Russian economy pretty much, they would react pretty quickly. But I think that the structure of the trade, which means what they export in general in Central Asia, and also the geographic component, is a pretty big region in that sense, do not make for sudden decision to be made. You can't improvise in that sense. If you want to diversify as a collective of states, or just as one of them, you need to have policies in place. And at the moment, the only Central Asian state that has had some kind of economic strategy in hand is Uzbekistan. The others, I'm afraid to say, have been quite conservative, very regressive in their choices. And in that sense, they've not been able to react to the changes. We saw it in Kazakhstan with the CPC. We saw it in Turkmenistan. We failed to take off in East-West cooperation with Azerbaijan. And to answer your question, I think that Turkmenistan should be open to the opportunities, but the current expertise, the current leadership are not going to be able to react quickly to the changes in geopolitics and the geoeconomics of the Eurasia widely defined.
Excellent points there, too, because it makes a really important distinction. When economists or political economists talk about the benefit of formal trade and regional trade, they do so based on these calculations of comparative advantage and maximizing national economic benefit. But as Luca pointed out, you know, the Turkmen economy isn't structured that way. It's structured as a set of opaque monopolies where political clients and the ruling family enrich themselves. And so given that, actually, freedom of trade would be threatening to that, right? And this is one of the real reasons we don't have more, you know, free trade and regional cooperation, because a lot of these sectors that we would assume would be natural candidates for expansion are actually controlled and provide rents to connected elites. And think about this. 90 to 95% of Turkmenistan's exports are either in minerals, oil, oil-related products, or cotton, right? All of those, again, have these sort of links to the state. So, you know, we just don't have a lot of local or small businesses that are waiting to be unleashed by potentially accessing new markets like Iran or Kazakhstan.
Okay, but then I want to follow up a little bit. You know, I'd mentioned that there's always this Trans-Caspian potential trade route. You know, I would point out at this point that the capacity of Aktau or the capacity of Turkmenbashi is effectively equivalent to the same capacity they got in Elat in Azerbaijan, right? So everyone can export to Azerbaijan. They don't have the capacity to do it. And then, of course, there's getting all the stuff through the Caucasus into the Black Sea. So that is not going to be able to fill the vacuum that's being created by the loss of Russian trade routes. So, you know, assuming that the Afghan north-south route is not going to open wide up anytime soon, and I think that's a fair assumption. We won't be seeing massive trade between the Indian Ocean and Central Asia through Afghanistan anytime soon. That leaves the rest of the Central Asians with a north-south trade route that has to go through Turkmenistan. Okay, they didn't sign the friendship agreement. Everyone agrees it's a good thing that Turkmenistan is at least showing up to these meetings and you know, certainly relative to Turkmenistan is being much more gregarious than they were in the old days. But they're right now they're a block, right? I mean, it's one thing that Turkmenistan didn't build the pipelines they needed to 20 or 30 years ago, which they could have enriched themselves with natural gas exports phenomenally, but they're actually preventing the rest of Central Asia from exporting goods to the Persian Gulf through Iran. And of course, there's all kinds of exclusions for Central Asian goods that pass through Iran and head to the Persian Gulf. And now we see there's a Turkish railway route. I mean, is there a limit to patience for Turkmenistan's isolation in Central Asia?
Do you want me to handle that, or should I let Luca, who's the Turkmen foreign policy expert? I mean, my view on this is what seems to you, Bruce, and I think most observers, is a very reasonable proposition of filling in a vacuum and playing this kind of sort of transit role, is something that is incredibly threatening to an existing structure of political economy, especially when logistics itself is tied into power structures, control and monitoring structures, right? So, you know, once you're able to sort of transit and ship things, you also keep records of things, right? You keep logs. You start recording more precise statistics about what's transiting and where and why. You know, things that we would consider to be normal and quite logical are actually incredibly threatening in the context of this type of political economy and this type of regime.
Okay, and then Luca, yeah, I want you to go in on this too. I mean, you know, in theory, and I heard what Alex said, but in theory, all we're talking about is letting trains go through. Or, you know, I mean, Turkmenistan took the big step a couple months ago of agreeing to let Uzbek trucks actually enter Turkmenistan and not transfer their cargo right over to Turkmen trucks immediately. But Uzbek trucks from Uzbekistan can drive all the way across Turkmenistan now, accompanied by Turkmen police, of course. But I mean. So they've kind of even set a precedent to show that it's possible to trade through Turkmenistan, and yet they're not embracing that at the moment. And that seems to be an obstacle to unity in Central Asia. Any thoughts on why? You know, Alex had a reason. What do you think?
No, I think that it's not going to happen. I mean, it's as simple as that. And, you know, this is the kind of situation that should have happened but has not developed. And we've seen the same thing. If you examine Kazakhstani-Uzbek relationship in economic and investment terms in the last 30 years, Well, those are the two biggest economies. They should have traded with each other. They should have invested into each other's economy. It was ridiculously low in both commercial and investment terms. And why? Because there was an authoritarian control over the economies, which did not see the easiest way out and always look for other partnership. I mean, someone would say because Karimov and Nazarbayev couldn't stand each other. It's certainly part of that. It's not just that. The fact the economy were not transforming to become more compatible. So since, you know, like we, I think that one of the points which we need to make in this episode is that we're seeing the return of these themes of integration, of failed integration, of failure to launch partnership and failure to expand the geography of the trade in the region, both internally and outwardly. I think that we should make a point that there is a set of barriers that the region authoritarian governments has erected when it comes to commercial ties, integration ties. And at the moment, it's pretty visible because Eurasia has overland market, as an overland commercial landscape, has been blocked by the war in Ukraine. Whereas we used to understand Eurasia as a much more dynamic, much more lively landscape, especially if we compare with the Caspian Sea, which on the other hand is quite immovable. And I think that the Central Asians do not have the responses to quickly react to the changes that you had, either Turkmenistan or Kazakhstan. We saw it, as I was saying before, with the CPC. And it is a shame because there is potential there. There is a potential now that the things sort of went their way, if you want, because they put them at the center, really, of a potentially expanding commercial network. But the way in which economy has been managed, has been understood, has been developed, is going to prevent further integration and expansion of geographic trades, both in Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan as well.
Thank you for mentioning, too, also the Russian-Ukrainian war, because now I want to talk about some of the elephants that were in the room that were barely addressed or not addressed at all. How much of this conference was held under the shadow of the Russian-Ukrainian war? And Alex had mentioned earlier, you know, that the Tajik president did bring up Afghanistan, as he is wont to do, typically in these things, but there wasn't a lot of discussion on this. Is there different views between the Central Asian states on the Russian-Ukrainian conflict that they wanted to avoid having to deal with this publicly as a group? And the same question about Afghanistan. Are there divisions in the way they view the situation in Afghanistan that made them want to avoid having to comment publicly on that? And Alex, I'll let you go first.
Great questions, Bruce. Well, I think the unity is that they would all rather not talk about the Russia-Ukraine war because nothing good can come of it, right? On the one hand, of course, they're concerned and alarmed by what Russia did, its continuing aggression, the impact it's had on the regions, the spike in food prices, inflation, energy, all of that. On the other hand, and this is the part we don't like to talk about, they're extremely concerned about sanctions. Like what the West is offering at the moment is sanctions and opprobrium, right? And compliance violations, as we recently saw with Uzbekistan and the Department of the Treasury. So this has no good for them, right? They're being squeezed from both sides. And, you know, the volatility that's going on as a result of this is absolutely concerning. The other common thing that they have is that they don't want to go on the record as either opposing or supporting the war. And, you know, I realize that I go against the grain here, but I do tend to think that we want to project onto all these Central Asian states that somehow they're really opposed to what Russia is doing and so forth. I just don't see the evidence for that, either from elites or from publics. I see an avoidance of wanting to pick sides, right, which you see also in UN votes. And the polling that I see, yes, for instance, in Kazakhstan, Kazakh language speakers tend to be less supportive of the war than Russian language speakers. But the numbers either way are not overwhelming. And that has to do with the Russian information environment, the cultural legacy, you know, all sorts of reasons there. So the war has absolutely no reward and all risk in terms of engaging with it. Afghanistan, a little bit of a different dynamic there. I think it's fair to say that four of the five Central Asian states would favor some sort of practical engagement with the Taliban. They're not going to take steps to unilaterally do it, not unless they get cues, certainly from Russia and China and from the UN itself. And, you know, Tajikistan has been the holdout, posturing here, you know, doing so for a number of different reasons, but, you know, certainly wanting to sort of emphasize the volatility and the militarization of that border. Again, I think the difference now in Afghanistan from the Central Asian perspective is that is what we were talking about before, the desire for regional economic cooperation through routes, whether it's Uzbekistan, Pakistan, whether it's, you know, a more of a kind of a regional genuine sort of connectivity. Afghanistan practically has to be a part of that. So the Central Asian states, barring Tajikistan, appear to be less ideologically inclined as they are last time. And so maybe that bodes more positively for sorting out a modus vivendi with a Taliban-run Afghanistan.
Okay, thank you very much. And Luca, it's the same question to you, but I also want to throw in too that, you know, again, the two countries that weren't on board with signing this 21st century friendship and cooperation country are the two countries that seem to be a lot closer to Moscow right now, right? Turkmenistan and Tajikistan. We've seen, you know, the Kazakhstan, you kind of get the undertones of this, especially with all these claims on northern Kazakh territory. And Kyrgyzstan's kind of been walking a tightrope. They look like they were kind of siding with Russia. And then because that got publicity, they made it real clear that they were neutral. But, you know, it just seems, is it more than a coincidence that the two countries, again, Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, which really kind of seem to be, you know, closer to the Kremlin on this issue anyway, you know, not supporting them maybe and not casting Ukraine aside, but certainly seem to be, you know, not adverse to being put in the same sentences as Russia, say, in the news and stuff. Is that a coincidence or do you think that they're kind of putting their chips in with Russia and the Kremlin at this point?
I don't think it's a coincidence. I don't even think that they're putting all the eggs in the Kremlin basket. I just think that they prefer not to say. They prefer not to expose themselves. And on this, I agree with Alex. I mean, what else could they do? That a certain segment, significant or not, but a segment nonetheless, of their power structure is connected to the support that Russia extends to them, both economic, political, or strategically. So it seems to me that they have no choice. Also, I mean, they are the two most, further away from Russia or the five regions. So geography is kind of different for them. But, you know, to make a more general point, Bruce, it is emblematic that we're talking about this very important regional integration meeting. You know, it happens once a year. We finally agree that it's important in Central Asia only with no external partner. And the most important issue in Eurasian politics, and currently even international politics, is simply not discussed. I mean, I think that there's a lot to say about that. This is not even the elephant in the room. It's bigger. It's the whale in the room, if you can fit it, you know. So it seemed to me that it matches, and on this I agree with Alex again, the pattern that we see from Central Asia, like just being on the fence when it comes to the war. The reality, though, is that if politically they seem to be dealing with the sort of polarization that emerged from the invasion of Ukraine, you know, it's either us or against us, which we see replicated at every level in the West, domestic level, economic level, and of course, foreign policy level, they haven't been able to address the economic downfall of that. So politically, they find a good strategy, which is stay on the farm, on the fence. But in the economic terms, the repercussion that the invasion of Ukraine has had on Central Asia has not been addressed by either of the five, really, if you think about it. Mostly because the economic agenda is constrained by the straitjacket of authoritarianism and lacks the imagination that you would need in a situation like that. So it's not an easy predicament, even because solutions are not cheap, are not short-term, and I'm not easy to find with either aggravating Russia or, as Alex noted before, creating problem with the sanction regime. So it is a particularly precarious situation. Now, the reality is that if there is a crisis coming from this, the regimes are insulated enough with the population because you know, we've seen a succession in Turkmenistan. There has been already a protest in Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan seems to be on the way of consolidation even further. The other two are a little bit more fragile, but I don't think that the kind of performance legitimacy sort of impact on the stability of the Tajik and the Kyrgyz regime as well. So I think that that's probably my main takeaway of this interconnection between the war and the summit in Kyrgyzstan, that they somewhat managed not to talk about it. But on the other hand, they have not identified a series of measures to respond to the economic repercussions of the war.
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning the protests, because this is one thing I wanted to get at. This part of it kind of went under the radar as far as their agreements and what they did talk about. They did have a lot of discussions about security, regional security, and you know, internet security and things like that. It seemed to be another issue that they didn't want to talk about publicly, but there's been protests in Kazakhstan, and then there was protests in Tajikistan, and there's protests in Uzbekistan, and it all turned violent. People died all over the place. This has got to spook them, especially when you figure out that Kyrgyzstan is the one country that hasn't had this kind of problem, and they're always a wild card, right? So, I mean, it really, you know, three of the five countries had violent, tragic events this year, and it's only July, you know, and Kyrgyzstan hasn't, but they have a history of this. Is this really probably the key area where they were having discussions as far as them is actual regional security and helping each other out in an age of protest? Because we know that they were talking about this kind of stuff, although they didn't elaborate on it. But it is clear that regional security and like I said, the ways to block outside threats coming from places like the internet was one of the main topics on the agenda, even though it wasn't addressed in written form up in the statements that they released later. But it's clear that this was a big part of the summit. How much of this summit, considering what's happening, was really focused on that, you know, the regional security and the protests in these countries? And Luca, you can go first, please.
Well, I'm going to be quick on this. I think that there is the establishment of a network of authoritarian solidarity in Central Asia. You see that the language has been passed on. If you read what Mirziyoyev said after the protests in Nukus, it's very, very similar to what Tokayev said after the event in January. And so, you know, emphasis on foreign forces, destabilization from the outside, and the answer was very similar, repression, repression, repression. So I would not be surprised if we hear the same. Well, we didn't hear because they didn't communicate that. If they said to each other, well, there is a developing threat to our stability, the region is becoming less stable, or because, you know, these states are stable until they're not. That's the problem with authoritarianism. And there is probably a convergence of views of the different leaders, not only on how to react, because they've always been repressive, but also to how to frame it. The language became more homogeneous, more systematically organized, and it seemed to me that this summit really developed a sort of unified views on this unrest which is going around the region at the moment.
Okay, and then Alex, I'm going to throw that in your corner too. Is the new basis for regional cooperation the fears about potential instability and protests in individual countries out there? Is that a good way to have a unity in Central Asia, is to focus on the security aspect of it internally?
Yeah, Bruce, it's a really good question. I don't think there's anything new about it, frankly. I mean, I think that, you know, again, going back to classic models of regional integration, we in the West tend to think, oh, first you do free trade and then the security stuff and the politics comes later because it's much trickier. In authoritarian countries, it's actually the reverse. Free trade is extremely destabilizing because of these, you know, patronage monopolies that authoritarians and kleptocrats enjoy. But what do they agree on? They agree on mutual protection against internal threats. And they define internal threats really expansively. So really, since the mid-2000s, you've seen at least two types of inter-authoritarian cooperation, right? One has been the active monitoring of cross-border movements by groups that might be trying to assert themselves. And then two, the creation of blacklists of political dissidents and the mutual recognition of those, right? And so we do know there's an SCO listing mechanism, which has grown exponentially. And the reason it's grown is that you have a lot of what political scientists refer to log roll. Each country lists their own pet dissidents and protesters and, threats both at the individual and organizational level. And each other country that's a member of that security group recognizes that, right? You have a CSTO list, although that one is not publicized. And in fact, there's some, controversies there about making that a more, publicly available thing. So, I don't see this as new. I see the impetus behind this as more urgent, especially given the unrest and protest and loss of life that you pointed out in three of these countries. So I think that's a big part of this. And then in terms of convergence, we see the convergence into dealing with trying to secure the space and to deal with protests forcefully as opposed to deal with the root causes of grievances, right? That in and of itself is a major sort of conceptual position. And it's one that's shared by China. It's one that's shared by Russia. And it's the most convenient one of all, right? Don't deal with the sources of grievances. Just make sure that you stamp out all street protests or all visible sign of protest because, those are the ones that are, destabilizing to the regime. Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of sources of pressure, right, to be more critically reflective about this. And so I think, you're going to see this convergence dynamic, just accelerate as far as I'm concerned. But you're absolutely right, Bruce. Regional security cooperation means mutual regime preservation, especially in the Central Asian context.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, and we're running to the end, and it is Friday night, and I promised I'd wrap this up quick, but is there anything from either one of you that you want to say that people missed that was significant about this conference? I mean, like I said, the most people just pointed to the fact that all five of them couldn't agree to sign this one agreement. But there was a lot of things going on there. Is there something that the public missed or that hasn't been dealt with sufficiently? And Alex, you can go ahead and start first, and then I'll ask Luca the same question.
Well, I don't think we haven't missed it. I just think that, the very fact that you have such storm clouds converging on the region, right? You're seeing, the regional impact of the Ukraine-Russia war. You're seeing the regional impact of the U.S. pullout and adjustments to that. And you're seeing a turbulent domestic situation. The very fact that they're meeting and talking about it, maybe they're not talking publicly about it, I think is a positive. But there are real headwinds in the region. And all of these authoritarian regimes are going to be severely tested in terms of their responsiveness, their accountability, and their ability to provide public goods in a time like this, right? If the new social contract really is forget about elections, forget about rights, representations, we're going to provide stuff for you. Well, this is the challenge. Let's see how you do in an economic downturn and what kinds of governance arrangements emerge as a result.
Great. Thank you. Luca?
I think, I agree with Alex with the fact, there are these storm clouds on Central Asia. I think that they should make more of a point of discussing the environmental security of the region because it's becoming more and more intractable and they keep looking at what is a collective threat in individual terms. And you would see the point in which the capacity of what Alex was mentioning before, so, forget about election, we're going to give you stuff. So the economic capacity is going to be very much impinged upon by the drama of climate change. And at least these generational leaders, like the predecessors, of course, have not engaged with this issue dramatically. And I think that this is something that, on the one hand, actually constituted a kind of a easier topic to discuss. Obviously there are many inverted commas there, but also is something that it's become quite urgent in my views, given, the way in which the geography and the climate of the region itself, it's done. So that is a missed opportunity, but it's something that, you know, for the last 30 years should have been dealt originally, and it's not, continue not to be.
Good point. I didn't hear much about the climate change in that, so thank you for bringing that up. Okay, and that brings us to the end of this program. Gentlemen, I thank you a ton. You know, I know you guys for a long time. I would love to be having this conversation for 4 or 5 hours in some bar somewhere, and I would be buying the drinks. But I do appreciate you being on the show today and explain. I mean, really, you know, you've covered a huge, huge ground here in this conversation. So my thanks to Alex Cooley from Barnard College, Columbia University, and Luke Anceschi from Glasgow University. This, once again, was the Medjlis Podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Bruce Pannier. I'm the host of the show, and I'm also the author of the weekly newsletter, Central Asia in Focus. If you wish to subscribe to either one of those, then please visit the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty website. That's rfarl.org. And a special thanks to my producer in Washington, Nathan Shoemaker. Appreciate all your hard work out there. Have a good week, everybody, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.